Now, Buck, I tell you what you do. You get your hat and you go on downstairs and you pick out two of my very best girls. No extra charge.
Two?
That's right.
Two for the price of one?
Exactly. That's a good boy.
Hello and welcome to Hello, This is the Doomed Show. I am Richard. Folks, I'm here with my favorite alligator posing as a crocodile, Simon. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
And, Oh, I almost did a British accent. I'm sorry. That was really stupid.
You should have done.
I've done my patented British accent once in a while. It's like, cheerio, man. Hello there, governor. No, I'm not doing that anymore.
Well, I should have done a Florida accent because, as we know, like all crocodiles and alligators that aren't from Texas are from Florida.
Yes. I've been told that Floridians have an accent, but I grew up in Montana and Georgia, and then I've lived in Florida so long, I don't hear it. So I don't know. But the important thing, before we even start tangentializing ourselves, is that we're here to talk about Eaten Alive, and not that one, that one. Mm-hmm. We had an actual listener request that we've been accidentally avoiding. It's just been a long time since this person made the request. We're talking about Glenn Del Rossi. Folks, Glenn is a cool dude, and find him on the Instagram. And if you're like us and you like to own the movies, you will be jealous because Glenn's collection is psychotically huge. But yeah, Glenn said, do the Toby Hooper one, 1976, or as we call him around here, Tuber. And it had been insanely long time since I'd seen this frickin' movie. Simon, I have a little trivia right out of the gate. You ready?
All right, yeah.
What do Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Eaten Alive, and Life Force, those three films, you know, not just Tuber's involvement, what do those three films have in common?
I don't know.
They're all based on true events. No. I had no idea that this was supposedly based on a true story. And there's a nice little documentary. Yeah. A very overly long, padded out documentary.
Oh, is that Arrow on the Blu-ray? Yeah, I didn't get a chance to watch that.
It's nice. It's fine. It's got lots of local color. It's got a guy telling a story. But it could have been 5 minutes. 5 minutes. And it was more than that. it was 20 minutes long, I think. I was like, nope.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, worth watching.
So this is Joe Ball, is it? The Alligator Man, the Butcher of Elmendorf, and the Bluebeard of South Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the things that Prohibition did and the things that World War I did to the human psyche were great. But yeah, he was a bootlegger, but more importantly, he was a ladies' man. A ladies' man. And the ladies that got involved with him, at best, they would lose their arm by one of his crocodiles. Alligators. Or they would just get murdered and buried on a beach somewhere.
Yikes.
But most people speculated after the case broke that he was caught with, after murdering his lady friends, they speculated that he had fed them to his alligators, which he did not, apparently. They have no proof that he did any of that, but it was too late. The urban legend grew.
Yeah.
Hold on, I'm stopping this clock here, so I'm ticking all over the soundtrack. Soundtrack? Man.
Yeah, it's
elevated our podcast.
What you're missing for this one would be one that has like a little tinkly music box sort of motif,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That starts running backwards.
Yeah. Oh boy, we'll talk about the music. Wow. Mm. Dude. But yeah, here is the radio spot. I found a sweet radio spot. I found a radio spot for Eaten Alive, and here it is.
If you were one of the millions of moviegoers who were electrified by the unbearable suspense and sheer terror of Jaws, get ready for Eaten Alive. Mel Ferrer, Carolyn Jones, Stuart Whitman, Neville Brand. Created by Toby Hooper, maker of the screen sensation The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Marty Rustin presents a new horror classic, Eaten Alive. Into this house of terror comes a handful of unsuspecting innocents.
Hello?
What happens to these people in Eaten Alive will give you the most chilling, terrifying 90 minutes you ever spent in a theater. Eaten Alive, a VIP picture rated R.
So yes, that is the radio spot. I thought about playing the TV spot, which has the title of Starlight. Is it Starlight Murder?
Starlight Slaughter.
Starlight Slaughter. Thank you. Okay, folks, I was telling Simon before we started recording that we could do an episode just on these alternate titles.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy.
Ooh, this was filmed as Death Trap, but of course it became Eaten Alive. It was also known as the Starlight Slaughter. In a French-Canadian town, it was Le Crocodile de la Mort, or the Death Crocodile, which I like very much. Let's see, in Colombia, it was Obsession Escalofriante, which, you know, I wish I'd kept my Google Translate open because, man. Wait, here it is. Chilling Obsession.
Hmm.
Which, yeah, I mean, that's when you think of Texas, you think of a chilling obsession. Let's see. Greece. I'm not even going to try to do the Greek pronunciation. It was On the Jaws of the Crocodile. In Japan, it was called The Devil's Swamp.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. In Italy. Oh, I'm looking forward to this. I don't know why. In Italy. It was called The Iguana with the Tongue of Fire. No, it was called That Motel by the Swamp. Oh, yes.
Oh, man. Sorry, I was just laughing to myself as well about the... Did you see the Spanish title?
No.
This is... And I just translated as well. It's Tramper Mortal.
Ooh, yes. That's one of our nicknames for Tampa. We call it Trampa.
Exactly. Which translates as Mortal Trap, apparently.
Ooh, nice.
Mm.
Of course, the alternate titles from USA, Brutes and Savages, which accurate.
Mm.
West Germany, it's Blutraus, which please just means blue trash, I hope.
Bloodlust.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Hey, how often have we said bloodlust in sync like that? Not enough. Not enough. Also, Legend of the Bayou, Murder on the Bayou, Horror Hotel Massacre, and of course, Horror Hotel, which that just brings up many other films that weren't actually called Horror Hotel. That's great. Mm. Oh, I love it. So I found a VHS, a good old British VHS, as folks who like the video nasties will know. This was a video nasty.
Mm.
And, oh, wait, did I? Oh, I did what you did.
What's that?
I pulled up the Italian one, the VHS.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You were like, yo, dog, I pulled up the wrong VHS. And I said, I'm not going to make that mistake. And then I did the same thing you did. So here's not the British Umberto Lenzi movie, which I've never seen. When I finally reached my peak saturation of my pants, I mean, saturation of cannibal movies in my pants, I did not watch Eaten Alive. I was just done. And I know it's more of a Guyana ripoff, like a Jim Jones ripoff.
Yeah,
but it's also cannibals.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I forget. I think it's Cannibal Ferox. I have a copy of, and I've never watched that either. But
Lord,
Yeah, I just because, you know, I've heard some of the behind the scenes stuff and it's like, no, just, I mean, any, it's like watching Bloody Moon again the other day and that snake bit, just always just kind of kills me a bit inside every time it happens. You think I should just skip past it, but, you know.
Web of the Spider, Antonio Margheriti, that has another snake killing in it. I'm like, guys, come on.
Yeah,
leave the snakes alone. But no, if you own the freaking cannibal movie, like just do it. Like, I honestly, I'm glad I've seen Cannibal Holocaust and I'm glad I've seen Cannibal Ferox. I will never watch them again. Mm-hmm. I don't ever need to see that again. And, you know, it's just, I don't give a shit about humans, but dude, leave the animals alone.
Oh, this is it. Yeah. But Eaten Alive, I did read a review, I think, on Mondo Digital about it. And it does sound like, you know, those bits aside, it could be quite entertaining and worth a one watch. You just, I suppose, have to brace yourself for a...
Dude, Cannibal Ferox is wildly entertaining.
Hmm.
Dude, like just for Giovanni Rombardo Radice.
Oh, right, yeah.
Like, what is his freaking Americanized name that he goes by?
Oh, is it John Morgan?
Morgan, yeah.
Yeah.
You got to see him. In that, and he is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is batshit crazy in that movie. It's great.
Mm, nice.
But anyway, so I found the LD video. This is a 1991 VHS tape. you sent me a beautiful one that had Robert Englund's freaking headshot looking all prim and proper with his smart guy glasses on, like, hey.
Is that, I'm guessing it's that Stuart Whitman who's next to him as well.
Yes, yes. This tape also, tape also has Stuart Whitman on it, looking like his headshot. It's so good. He's by the beach, looking crispy and tan. All right, here's the tape. In the brutal and garish tradition of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, director Toby Hooper serves up horror Southern style brand a psycho. What? There's fake blood drops right on the sentence I'm trying to read. So I'm like, what? Serves up horror Southern style brand a psychopath. Oh, Neville Brand. Okay.
Yeah.
Neville Brand. See, just use both names. They're trying to save on the printing costs. A psychopath who just happens to own a hotel keeps his pet gator on the hotel grounds. Guests who happen to upset the management become the next meal. With a lavish cast and spellbinding suspense and terror, Eaten Alive is a lurid and unforgettable spectacle. Yes.
Mm.
Agreed with those words. I can't believe I almost read the frickin' Cannibal Ferox-y Umberto Lenzi one. That's ridiculous. After you warned me, you were like, don't do it. Don't screw this up, Richard. I'll hang up on you. See, that's when I do that voice, that's scary.
Hmm.
So, folks, we're going to spoil this movie, but I got to tell you, this is not a plot movie. This movie is folks show up, folks get done in, some folks don't, and then everybody pretty much dies except for like three people. It's great.
Yeah.
But that does not mean this isn't something you need to see to be believed.
Absolutely.
I mean, what else was Toby Hooper going to do to follow up? I mean, he had grand plans, according to him on an interview, a very, I would say, low-key interview for him.
Is that the... There's two. Those are the only... Aside from the commentary, the only extra I watched preparation for this were the... There's a newer one, I think, with him, which is quite short, and there's a longer archive one, I think, from
I should have watched the long... I watched the newer one. He was very tired. He had a lot of health problems at the end of his life, so I wasn't too surprised.
Yeah, you could definitely tell, I mean, the difference of what I think the best part of 10 years between that, how energetic he is and the earlier one versus, yeah, like you say, he sounds either tired or kind of a bit, I don't mean this to be harsh, just, you know, like a little bit stoned. And it's funny, it's in the commentary, they're saying, you know, sometimes you'd kind of have to lean in and sort of listen to him. So he wasn't always, you know, for being, you know, a very smart guy, like not always best been able to articulate, you know, his ideas necessarily.
And he was an introvert. He was a very, very reserved person. He didn't like talking, you know?
Yeah, I think on the commentary, this is William Finley is talking about, he was trying to get Toby, you know, get in contact with him to see if he'd be on the commentary. He's like, I can't even find an address for him. Like, he'd just gone into the wilderness.
One day, Brad and I are going to do like a retrospective on a good old Tuber. Because, you know, we find that... he gets maligned.
Yeah.
Far too much. And yes, he had a lot of issues, and his career certainly didn't go the way that he expected. Mm-hmm. And you know, he was his own worst enemy in some cases, and sometimes just shitty luck. And then of course the bevy of personal problems is just, it's just very sad. But
yeah,
we'll get to that on another show. The main thing is the breakout insanity of Texas Chainsaw Massacre meant that he was ready to push the limits to see what he could do. Mm. And so he was writing a noir thriller, and he asked for X amount of money, and there wasn't a studio around that was going to give him. He's like, I'm ready for the big time. And they were like, no, you're not. Go away. So the opportunity to make something a little more in his style, which he probably, based on how this movie feels, probably felt trapped in this style. But damn, if he didn't make something very special here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, despite all the kind of plot overlap, I guess, or just general similarities between this and Texas, I mean, it just feels so wildly different at the same time.
Yep. He was paired up with his pal, Kim Henkel. I believe that's how you pronounce it. Kim Henkel, who wrote Texas Chainsaw Massacre with him, I believe. I mean, I closed all my Wendy's. Yeah, so this guy was a regular fixture with the Texas Chainsaw franchise. He would, you know, write different movies and produce different movies and stuff. I'm just glad that he wrote Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation.
Freaking, that's the only one I've still not seen, actually.
Dude, I remember when everyone hated that film, everyone, and then the internet happened, and there's that movie has so many fans. It is so funny, and I'm one of those fans. I really like it. He ain't seen anything like it. It's out there.
Yeah, I need to get to that. So I've enjoyed all the other ones I've seen.
Me too.
You know, obviously two. Three, I've only seen once, but I thought that was good. And various remakes, especially, did you see Leatherface?
Haven't seen that one.
Guys Who Did Inside. Yeah, I've seen that the once, and that was really good.
See, I can't believe I haven't seen that, because I love Inside. I mean, I can't, you know, watch it a lot, but...
Yeah, I've seen it once. It's been a
great movie right there.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kim Henkel and him teamed up. This was produced by someone with an amazing name. We got Mohammed Rustam, Samir Rustam, and Marty Rustam. I'm just wondering what else these folks...
Oh, there is something.
Marty,
you might have seen this already. A film that keeps coming up at the moment. I think, I want to say Vinegar Syndrome may have recently put it out.
They did.
I know there's been some podcasts about it. Is it Psychic Killer?
Oh, I was looking at Evils of the Night. Yes.
Ah, right.
I've Psychic Killer, I believe, was one that was in the a lot of budget compilations. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It was in a lot of budget ones. I just never watched it. Mm. But it looks bonkers. produced Marty Rustam. He did that and Evils of the Night, which I've heard is completely crazy. Which, of course, another Neville Brand special.
Oh, yeah. I recognize the poster.
Yeah. I forgot what I was... Was I making a point? I don't remember. Unlike Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this is not... This is set in Texas, but this is not the Texas you know, which I've only been to Corpus Christi, Texas, which is a living nightmare. Human beings not meant to live there. And I was there in August.
Oh, no.
With my grandparents, who were freaking jerks. It was so bad. We visited my aunt, bless her heart. She had a ranch out there. And my God, it was... I mean, a horse broke free of the gate and broke its leg. They had to freaking shoot it, like, while we were there. Oh, my God. It was the worst vacation. And then driving from Palm Beach to Texas with my grandparents and their little car, my sister and I. Oh, my God, dude. You haven't lived until you've slept at a rest stop in a tiny, like, Volkswagen... freaking Jetta style car. Oh my God. Yeah, I've never been back to Texas ever. That's my whole summation of Texas. I know that Scott and our pal David Asesino are like, that's not all Texas though, brother.
Yeah, they both live in Austin, don't they? I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds like a pretty cool city, I have to say.
Yes, they live in one of the good places. Not like Tampa, though. Come on. Why did I buy a house here? Anyway, they went soundstage for this bad boy. Holy shit, dude.
Oh, yeah.
And I am so glad they did.
Oh, me too. Did you see where they were thinking of filming before that? Probably only came up, I think, in that second Toby Hooper interview.
It was in Texas, wasn't it?
Well, he mentioned something about the Shambhala Preserve, which was it's a animal sanctuary in Acton, California, that I think was started by, well, it's got Tippi Hedren's name all over it anyway.
Oh, boy.
I think her house was around there. And they were going around it, and there's basically the, like, you know, don't open a door because you might come face-to-face with an actual lion, you know, just, like, roaming around the house. But, yeah, then I think I forget the exact chain of thought, but, yeah, then I think he got to thinking of just kind of what the film was and maybe, you know, the kind of the core of it and the feeling he was going for and thought, actually, I kind of want to go a bit Wizard of Oz or, like, weird fairy tale for it and, create this kind of sort of surreal Twilight world, as I think he described it, which he certainly succeeded doing.
Yep. Like, there's a moment where everything turns red, like the only light coming through on this hotel, the starlight, and it's accompanying a little swamp area there.
Yeah.
It's just blood red lights. And you think, well, you know, maybe the sun's supposed to be setting in that weird twilight. But then, no, it just stays red for, like, the majority of the film. It's so good. Mm. It is so good. All right. So soundtrack, the music for this thing, was done by someone named Wayne Bell and Toby Hooper himself. And, of course, and yes, Wayne Bell was also on good old Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And the music is just, it's like when you go to the music store and you go to the keyboard room. Mm-hmm. And your eyes go right to the Moogs and go right to the frickin' Korg synthesizers. And you just run up and you start mashing them the keys with your beautiful, swollen, fat fingers. Talking about myself here. And you just start making every noise you can think of and pressing all the buttons randomly. And you get the score for Eaten Alive.
Oh, God, yeah.
Except for all the reverse effects and all the, like you said, the clocks.
Music box or something, I think.
Yes, music boxes and frickin' like percussion played in reverse, cymbals and like probably a tin can and a frickin' drumstick. Like just weird, weird sounds and always affected. And it's a really unsettling score. Speaking of unsettling scores, this is totally off topic. Mm. I have Keith Emerson's score for Inferno.
Oh,
on vinyl.
Yeah.
Dude, I don't know why it was like $12.
There are a lot of copies of that about, yeah, so it does look quite cheap. Yeah.
I think they overestimated how popular the soundtrack was going to be. And so it's really easy to find that on vinyl. And it's not scary to me. It is aggravating and like unsettling in the truest sense.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I had trouble. I was cleaning the music room because, of course, as usual, whenever I have a music project going on, there's chords and guitars and keyboards. Everything's laying all over the floor. Hmm. And so I put on that to clean, and I got that cleaning done so fast because I just wanted to get away from the music. And I love that score, but it is so obnoxious.
Oh,
in a good way.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be, but
I know a lot of people don't like it, but
Oh, no. I think they don't like it because it's not all synthesizer. I think if they hadn't had the money for the orchestra and instead they had to cut costs and do like all synths, I'd get really creative with a smaller group of musicians, I'm sure it'd be a classic. If it had just been Goblin, people would have been all over it. They would have said, "I'm all over it like a bag of chips." Which that might not be what people say, but I would not listen to this score on vinyl in the darkness of my music room. This is really, truly scary. Like, ugh!
It is completely like the film is just completely unhinged. And like, I love how there's no build up to it. It's like straight away, the titles come on and instantly it's like we're up to 11 in terms of insanity.
God, yes. I am getting these lovely actresses mixed up because the one thing about this movie is they wanted some ladies.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted lots of ladies Who is our main girl at the beginning? Because we have that fake final girl thing.
Yes, we have a few kind of like callbacks to Psycho, I guess, in this. And yeah, the first one, it's Roberta Collins who
you
first see with, and you got a lovely kind of graphic match, you know,
yes.
From the moon to old box belt.
Oh my God. Roberta Collins, for fans of my childhood, she was in freaking Hard Bodies, which I probably told the story of my grandpa. Yes. Making me watch Hard Bodies, and then me having to pretend I was asleep so he wouldn't think I was watching Hard Bodies. Mm-hmm. But she was also in frickin' Saturday the 14th, the wildly terrible and great comedy horror film that, of course, is not a Friday the 13th parody of just capitalizing on the name.
Mm.
But I love her. So she's a prostitute. She's a new prostitute. She's managed to get a job at a brothel called Miss Hattie's. And the first line of the movie is delivered by her John, who's played by Robert Englund. And he says, how can I say this without using dirty language? My name is Rake the Rex Bag, and I like to make the sex act. How'd I do? Did I cover that up pretty good?
No, that was spot on. I had a variation on that as well. It's
let's see what you got.
My name is Santa and I'm raring to Fanta.
My name is Fucker and I'm here to make love to your butt. No, he is Robert Englund. This is his most terrifying performance. Forget Freddy.
Mm.
Forget Phantom of the Opera. This is, oh God, he makes my skin crawl.
Yeah,
I mean, he's a gorgeous young man.
Hmm.
Apparently, even good-looking people can be evil, Simon.
Who would have thunk it?
I know. That's why I'm so benevolent, because I have this hideous face. But yeah, he's proposing unwanted butt sex. He's trying to get to the end of Strip Nude for Your Killer at the beginning of the movie. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
But she does not like it, and she freaks out, understandably so, and she fights him off with a chair. And then the weirdest thing that's ever happened on film of any movie ever, Carolyn Jones of Morticia Addams fame and many other, she did a lot of frickin' weird movies after the Addams Family was over. Carolyn Jones is wonderful. She plays Miss Hattie, and Miss Hattie is the queen bee of this brothel, the madame. Simon, what did you think of her makeup when she first walked in the room, and were you scared?
I hadn't, until I was taking notes for this, ever really noticed this, God knows how. And maybe because, you know, I got that new Blu-ray Dawn of the Dead, like recently I watched a few times, I thought the makeup kind of reminded me a bit of the zombies in that, actually. It's not as later in the film, when Mel Ferrer and I forget the lady's name, you know, come in, it doesn't look as kind of, you know,
bonkers,
what the fuck, yeah. But I was getting total Dawn of the Dead vibes off it.
My heart sunk because on the Blu-ray she looks dark gray or slightly black. I was like, oh, no. They're not doing a blackface, are they? But I mean, I think they wanted to make her unrecognizable. But the thing is, Carolyn Jones, she has a distinct face. So you can put a half pound of makeup on her face, like a weird mask, but you still have to change the shape of her face. So the makeup is crinkling while she's talking. It is so unsettling. My only thing I could think of was like, maybe she had syphilis a long time ago and it chewed up her face. So she was putting like that foundation stuff that's like cadaver putty or something. She looks like a walking cadaver.
Well, it was that, what do they call it? Is that mortician's wax? Because that would
be... That's it.
Yeah, that would be kind of funny because there's, on the commentary, there's a good few people on it. One of the person who probably has some of the most interesting insights was Craig Reardon, who did, at least credited as doing makeup, but I think he said his only contribution to makeup in this was making up this girl's breasts so they would like match the rest of her body.
Wow.
Anyway, he mentions, I forget the guy's name, another guy who he had come in ostensibly to replace. It might not be on here. But anyway, yeah, he had been fired or threatened to, but in a bit of a canny move, he'd said, well, you need me because no one else is going to be able to match these makeups, which Craig Reardon's like, yeah, I don't really think that's right. But anyway, he managed to hang on by the skin of his what's-it. And yeah, it sounds like he was a fan of the old mortician's wax. So yeah, I think you were right there.
Dude, I rebuilt my groin with mortician's wax. Hello?
So I was thinking that's funny as well, isn't it? Oh, yeah, was she, Morticia as well, you're saying.
Hey, look at that, Morticia's wax. I like
and
that.
One final little, simonicity, I guess I had while I was watching this, taking notes this time. I got to thinking about if you remade this later, would that have meant that you got Angelica Houston to play this role? And literally the second I thought that, somebody said like, oh yeah, we live in Houston. And I thought, oh my God.
Oh, yeah, look at
play,
that.
You know, plate of shrimp.
Plate of shrimp? Yeah. Oh my God, he's giving me Repo Man flashbacks. Oh my God, thank you. So Hattie kicks her out because, you know, you have to do what Hattie tells you.
Hmm.
The nice lady, believe her name is Ruby?
Hmm.
She's this older black lady who works there who's very kind, and she gives our pal Clara. Jeez.
Mm.
So yeah, yes, Roberta Collins plays Clara. Thank you, brain. She gives Clara money to go, and she recommends she go to the Starlight.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, lady, you have just murdered someone.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. It's weird because she does warn her of like, don't mention where you're from. But it's like, Judd, he soon susses it out anyway, almost like he's psychic or something. Or I don't know, she just got that look about her.
So our buddy, Neville Brand, character actor, from Hell, 138 credits. He plays Judd, who is a probably World War II vet, who is completely deranged, out of his mind, who's running this ramshackle hotel, Holiday Inn, with a freaking, what he calls a crocodile as its main draw for tourists. Of course, it's not a crocodile. It's an alligator that he's just kept in a pen and been feeding for years. So it's like as big as a car, or it's smaller than a child in a few shots. This alligator goes through some changes and it has one of the funniest moments. I mean, it reduces its size by like a solid 2/3, maybe more. And then in order to show it moving, they just drag it real fast with its floppy legs.
It's weird that somehow I'd noticed, but now I'm thinking, did you hear in any of the extras? Apparently somebody left it in the tank overnight or maybe over a weekend or something. And it basically bloated to like, Toby Hooper saying it must have soaked up about 100 gallons worth of water. So gone like, I don't know, like three times the size or something, and they had to like leave it outside. No. And I'm just thinking, dude, I wish they just used it, you know, as this fucking ginormous thing, like half a house at the end.
Poor
just
tuber.
Eats everything. Yeah.
After, if you have to read a book, or there's multiple books about the production of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The one that,
Who played Leatherface in the first movie? Oh my God.
I just had a complete brain fart.
I'm so sorry. I'm taking you down with me. Gunnar Hansen.
Yes, of course.
Gunnar Hansen wrote a book and he talked about his experiences filming that shit. And it makes total sense why they would go the route of sound stages so that they weren't in 110 degree heat, you know.
Oh, it just
but
sounds brutal.
Yeah. It just, you knew, you know, it's still going to be screwed up. Like, Toby Hooper is in that vortex of insanity where even when he's on his best behavior, shit happens. It's just crazy. So I love it. Oh, I regret not listening to the commentary now.
It's a shame that he's not on it, but let me see who was. I think there's about five different people. So I have like two sets of notes here because obviously, like you say,
William. No, you're good.
So yeah, on the commentary, it was Marty Rustum, Roberta Collins, William Finley, Craig Reardon, and Kyle Richards.
Nice.
Who I think Kyle Richards, she spends most of the time watching. She mainly, you know, they're not all together. It's like one of those where they've done bits of interviews and kind of put it together.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think she spends most of the time watching it, having PTSD flashbacks to like nice. Something that she was in.
Oh, that poor thing.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Neville Brand was in freaking everything, but he owns this shit. His freaking crazy is my kind of crazy. It is so gibbering and weird, and like he can barely interact with people in real time. He's so messed up. It's so crazy. It takes him like a couple of minutes of leering at Clara, and then a few seconds on the stairway after she signs in, and she goes I believe he infers that the crocodile ate a black person. Oh my God, it's insane. But then he realizes she's from Miss Hattie's. Mm-hmm. And that's the trigger for him to try to beat her up, rape her. It's unclear. I think he doesn't know what he was going to do.
Yeah, exactly.
But they both fall down the stairs together. He's briefly stunned as she's crawling out. And then he comes after her with a pitchfork.
Mm.
And he forks her. on the patio, which is a euphemism I use all the time. And then, of course, he feeds her to the crocodile / gator. Now, crocodiles and gators, they don't eat very often.
Right.
Yes, they will eat a person, especially like someone, you know, who's maybe is drowned, or, you know, if a gator gets you, it takes you underwater and spins you and knocks you unconscious and drowns you, and then it saves your body for later. But this gator... It's like binge eating these people. If he's going to eat one person or even a dog, he's not going to do anything for, you know, days. Mm. I mean, I'm not a gator expert, but I do live in Florida and I have seen them many times.
Yeah.
About the only thing going here is I live on a lake.
Yeah.
But since this lake is not connected to any of the rivers, we don't actually have gators behind my house. It's not impossible, but it would have to be a gator that like was hopping from like lake to lake. It would have to like actually travel between lakes, and they don't like to do that so much. But anyway, I digest. And then the All-American Family shows up. As soon as he covers this murder up, barely, then we get the freaking, I guess, weird Afro wig of Marilyn Burns.
Yeah,
which is so great. She plays Faye, and honestly, with or without the wig, I love her so much. She is such a joy to watch in a movie, especially in this one. I just adore her in this movie.
Yeah.
She's married. She is married to William Finley as Roy. William Finley of good old Phantom of the Paradise. And also, from the Funhouse, another tuber jam.
Oh, yeah.
And Sisters, Black Dolly. He was a big De Palma favorite. And he's one of those people that when you... I'm just shocked right now. Only 22 credits.
Yeah, you'd think he'd be like in everything, but...
Underutilized, which makes me think he just chooses what he likes to do. And he's probably a big stage actor or something. Mm-hmm. But he was in a freaking movie that I was talking to with Brad, not on the show, but a little movie called Silent Rage.
Is that the kind of Chuck Norris slasher?
Yes, Chuck Norris versus a slasher killer, which is ridiculous.
He's in I didn't mean to watch this because, you know, that clip I sent you from the Video Nasties guide about this? Guy he's talking, he mentions Night Terrors, which I think both William Finley and Robert Englund were in.
I need to see that.
Yeah, you were saying it's kind of underrated.
I would say so. Oh, that poster is amazing. Oh, my God. Damn, I got to catch up on my tuber.
Me too. I
feel bad. He's underrated even among me. So their marriage is something. Their little girl. Who is their little girl?
Oh, that's Kyle Richards. From Halloween Watcher in the Woods.
Kyle. Thank you. Because, you know, it's like one of those things where you're like, I have seen this actress 1,000 times, but my brain won't connect something obvious. So, yes, this is our buddy here. She was Lindsay from Halloween. Lindsay! I love this little girl. Don't love children. in movies very much, especially when they're screeching their entire performance. And in fact, she wasn't screaming enough. They have to actually like ADR and add more screaming from this little girl in, where it's like she's screaming, but her mouth isn't moving. It's so funny.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, if she got paid by the scream as well, she could have retired then.
Yeah, I'm surprised she's still working.
Mm.
Maybe her parents stole her screaming money. Bastards. But this family is so broken. Mm. They show up, and their little dog, who's, I believe she's saying Snoopy,
mm-hmm.
but the dog's name is... the hell was the dog's name?
Yeah,
they actually credited the dog. I was so happy.
Scuffy?
Scuffy. But it sounds like she's saying Snoopy.
Yeah, it's weird because I got the impression that like this dog was going to have like loads of credits from, I think, something said in the commentary that it had like some kind of entourage, or it was like the most famous person on set.
What?
Or something. Or maybe it was just like the handlers or something. I don't know. It could understandably be very protective, I'm sure.
When that dog jumps out of the car and hits the ground and it's got those little legs, like the little, because I always think dogs like that come with a soundtrack of sound effects when they walk. It's just so, my heart is so filled with joy. He's such a cute doggy. Mm. And of course, he immediately gets eaten by the crocodile, which they have this poor dog swimming in this garbage moat that they have, or garbage pond, and this fake ass alligator's like holding onto it. It's so ridiculous. But our little friend, Angie, the little girl, she sees this happen, so she's traumatized. They manage to keep her from getting eaten by the alligator, and they drag her inside. Everyone's covered in mud and dirt and screaming and screaming and screaming. And then my favorite marital bliss moment happens, where Roy is trying to comfort his daughter, and he's kind of a sociopath. Like, he's going through the motions of trying to be a person. Like, he's massively inconvenienced. This is my theory. He's massively inconvenienced by this traumatic event to his daughter. So he's doing the most half-assed shit he can to try to comfort her. And when it doesn't work and his wife tells him off, then he does the I'm crushing your head thing.
Oh, that, kind of psychotic sort of, I don't know how to describe it. Just like zooms on his face. He looks like he's about to burst a blood vessel.
You think it's part of the soundtrack, this high-pitched whining. Mm. It's coming from him as he's resisting the urge to kill his wife in front of the cameras.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And then he has this whole diatribe about how bad he feels about the whole situation, but then he makes it about him.
Yeah.
And how he's watching his wife put out a cigarette. And then he's like, why don't you just put it out in my eye? Put it out in my eye. And then he's acting like his eyeball came out and is rolling on the floor. And he's doing this huge production, one-man show of him picking up an eyeball off of the floor. But none of it is anything because of her withering stare.
Yeah.
When he's trying to comfort and she gives him that look, I think I would lose it too. Because that shit is just brilliant. God, what a weird... I want a whole movie of just these two characters.
Oh, it's just like kind of acting masterclass, really, isn't it? And it's...
wild.
Yeah, I hadn't thought until somebody mentioned it how Roy, he's kind of like a weird mirror of Judd in a way. They're just like both so all over the place. It's like even they don't know, I think, any, you know, 1 30-second period to another, kind of what mood they're going to be in or how they're going to act.
Yeah. And they're not good at, like, people, period.
No,
like
it's, no.
So Roy decides to do something. He runs out, grabs a shotgun out of his trunk, and he goes to kill the freaking gator himself. And Judd is, of course, beside himself trying to stop him. And he shoots into the water and misses. And they cut to his wife and daughter. And they're reacting to the gunshot. And she says, what does she say? Daddy's just slaying off to slay the dragon. Oh, my God. But, of course, he doesn't slay the dragon. Instead, he gets frickin' attacked by Judd with a giant scythe, which is all over the artwork. So we knew this was coming. And then he gets scythed to death and then thrown in the water. And Judd pretends like nothing's happened and brings the bags up for Faye.
Stanley Tools and Hardware have been helping people do things right for over 100 years. And today, people are depending on Stanley quality more than ever. They're doing things themselves to save money. They're also discovering that doing things with your own two hands adds something to life that money can't buy.
Stanley, we want to help you do things right. And making our home beautiful is doing things right.
Stanley Tools Hardware and Drapery Hardware.
We want to help you do things right.
We have met Mel Ferrer. So Mel Ferrer is playing Harvey Wood, and he and his daughter, Libby.
Oh, is
he?
Yeah.
Libby.
Libby Wood, yeah.
Kristen Sinclair. Mm. This woman is stunning on camera. Mm. The camera loves Kristen Sinclair. Oh, my God.
I've got to ask you something. This is another kind of weird connection to the Umberto Lenzi Eaten Alive. Now, I know that Mel Ferrer, yeah, I'm pretty sure I've got to check this now. He was in that, like, what, 4 years later?
Yep.
Now, what I find even weirder than that was, for some reason, whenever I look at Kristen Sinclair in this, my brain makes me think of, is it Janet Agron? Is that how you pronounce her name?
Yeah.
From City of the Living Dead. Now, yeah, this is where, like I say, it gets weird, because I think she was also in Eaten Alive with Mel Ferrer.
What? Yeah, dude, that is a good call. They do have quite a bit in common.
Mm.
Like, their faces are very similar. Wow, good call.
Yeah, thank you.
So they're looking for Clara. Mel Ferrer is Mr. Patience. He is how I am all the time with people, where I'm so stressed out, I look like I'm about to have a coronary.
Oh, God.
No, I'm not really. But he's, oh my God, Mel Ferrer, legendary actor. Mm. Him going to Italy was one of the best things that happened to Italy, because he brought this real classical Hollywood thing, even when he probably did not give a flying fuck about the movies he was in.
Yeah,
but he never acted like he didn't give a fuck.
Oh no, he's a total pro. Yeah,
He was in The Antichrist, one of my all-time favorite Exorcist ripoffs.
Mm.
Good old Alberto De Martino joint right there. Love it. But so they go to the hotel and they're trying to find Miss Hattie's, and don't say Miss Hattie to Judd. It all goes to hell. But they go off and they get the sheriff. And we'll get back to them in a second. But first, not knowing her husband is dead, Faye gets her daughter to calm down. And then she goes to, you think this hotel's nice, wait till you see the bathroom. She's in the creepy bathroom getting ready to take a bath or just wash her feet and legs. I'm not sure what she's doing. And Judd just bursts in and kidnaps her and ties her to a bed. Oh, well, first he puts the shower curtain over her head and starts slapping the shit out of her. Then he tries to kill the kid by chasing the kid under the house once he's, securely tied up, Faye. And man, he is trying to murder this kid.
Mm-hmm.
There is no, ambiguity to what he's going to do to the child. He's chasing her with the frickin' scythe. And of course, she goes into the house where, if we went through the whole saga of this little girl under the house, this show would be 13 hours long. It is ridiculous how long she spends under this house and how much time, a little too much time is my one criticism of this movie. They spend way too much time on this little girl.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like you try and lay everything out that happens in this film in a kind of linear fashion, and it would seem like it would be really, really long. But once it kind of gets going and you have all the different threads weaving in and out, it does kind of move pretty damn quick.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So Mel Ferrer and his daughter, they go see the sheriff, which is yet another character actor.
Mm.
Frickin' Stuart Whitman. Good Lord. This guy is basically a walking bottle of human stagger, a walking bottle of human swagger. Dude, 189 credits, TV, 70s TV, 80s TV, movies. He was just a great freaking dude as far as dependable, I'm always the same in everything guy.
Yeah. A little bit of trivia. I think, Toby Hooper, he says that he gets a bit confused as, I think Toby sometimes did, bless him, not that I can talk. He said at first that he thought Stuart Whitman was the best man at his last wedding, but he's like, oh, no, he signed the register or whatever, as a witness. Still, yeah, like you say, dependable,
Hey, I was there. He probably was playing multiple roles.
No doubt.
But he may have been the bridesmaid. Never know. But yeah, he's the sheriff. He's the, this is my town. We're cool. Nothing going on here. We're good to go. You want to go to Hattie's place? All right, come on, let's go to Hattie's place. And it is, oh my God. I wrote in my notes, at Hattie's place, Miss Mona ain't nowhere to be found. And so Shout out to Best Little Whorehouse in Texas fans out there.
All right, yeah.
In 1 week, Burt Reynolds. Woo! Dolly Parton.
Ta-da!
And Charles Durning of Breaking All the Rules.
Come on over here and give me a little lip lock.
It's the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Parental discretion advised, 1 week from tonight.
Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's, my Lord.
I was thinking about it, though, because I think on the on the artwork, which I think on the Blu-ray, which I think someone's taken for some promotional materials, it says the best little horror house in Texas.
Yes, absolutely. The re-release probably capitalized. That's so good. I highly recommend it if you haven't seen it. It's just one of those musicals that it seems like a heterosexual movie. Until you get to the football team, and the football team in the movie is all made up of dancers, like male dancers, not stereotyping here at all.
Okay.
But it's just a lot of beautiful, beautiful men in the showers together, hooting and hollering and dancing. And it's just the most beautiful thing ever. It was made for a gay audience. Like, just no way it wasn't. It's so great. There's too many jock straps and nothing else happening in that scene. So, yeah.
Oh, boy.
You can fill your cup. Ha ha. Come on.
While we're talking about such things, you just something I was laughing at before when I was looking at the credits. I don't know. I'm sure he's not actually named in the movie. Like, and we got confused with Clara as well. Something she's actually named in the movie. But anyway, somebody here who's a Sig Sekowitz plays. I swear I'm not making this up. I don't think I am anyway. Let's squint at this. Check I'm not hallucinating. Plays Deputy Girth.
Ooh. Wow, my cup runneth over.
Exactly.
Nice. That is actually my nickname. So speaking of Robert Englund's Girth, he and good old Judd have a relationship. Mm. I almost thought they were supposed to be father and son at first. But our pal Buck likes to bring girls to the hotel and rent a room and do naughty things with them. And Judd is too desperate not to take the money and actually let him do that. But he gives him so much grief. So we have Buck coming and going. I want to make sure we mention that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because they, after Hattie's place, Mel Ferrer goes back to the hotel and Sheriff offers Libby a drink. So they go to this nasty bar where there's trouble afoot, where Buck and his friends, his crazy friends, are like giving people grief, picking fights, being shitty. And our buddy Buck runs off with Janice Blythe, who plays Lynette. And Janice Blythe, man, Hills Have Eyes, Hills Have Eyes 2, Phantom of the Paradise, The Incredible Melting Man. Oh, my Lord. Woo. I really like her. She's just bubbly and silly and sexy and amazing. So he takes her off to Judd's place after the sheriff kicks him out of the bar. And I gotta say, Buck is kind of on a roll tonight because he didn't get anywhere with Clara, but he did get somewhere with two prostitutes. So when one prostitute doesn't do what you want, they'll do you an upgrade. They'll give you two. So not only did he presumably have sex with two prostitutes, now he's got this girl. And I hope he's using a whole body condom because he's covered in sores, presumably. But his good luck doesn't last as Judd is trying to cover the sounds of Faye, who's tied to a bed because, of course, he's murdered Mel Ferrer now, most spectacularly with the scythe, got it stuck in his throat.
Oh, yeah, that's probably the, yeah.
It just goes on and on and on. And I'm like, why are you still alive? You're supposed to have a heart condition.
Yeah, so, no, I thought the exact same thing, yeah. It's like, what?
So he cranks up the radio to cover the sounds of the lovemaking and so they won't hear the little girl screaming down under the frickin' house and won't hear Faye banging away with the bed. And dude, I'm going to spoil one of my thoughts in this movie. I never want to hear country music again.
I know ever. About this. It's like, is country the only music played in hell?
Yes,
you know,
this movie filmed in hell, soundtrack by Country Hell Band.
I think the only respite from that we have is like a bit of mariachi music or something.
Yes, the they play some wonderful, they switch it up. And my brain is so fried from all the country that I had to struggle to hear what kind of music they'd switch to eventually. But sure enough, Our pal Buck, who likes to make the sex act, he gets too curious and angry because of the loud radio, and he ends up getting gotten by the gator.
When that happened, I swear I should have gone and rewinded this to check, but I could have sworn I heard the Wilhelm scream, but I think it was just Robert Englund.
Dude, oh my God, I would have cried laughing. I love that freaking scream, as you know.
Yeah.
So after he gets gotten, that's when the gator shrinks to the little tiny size, because in order to get rid of the little girl, Judd pulls, with the scythe, pulls the fence back so that the gator can get under the house and eat the little girl. And that's when we get the shot of it turning into a tiny little thing and then scooting across the floor after. And it's so bad.
I wonder if all this size disparity is further compounded by apparently Kyle Richards says she was kind of, I think, as you can imagine, especially with being chased by Neville Brand, yes. And even the adult characters, because he was apparently really so inhabiting the role and just
of course, gotta go method
on the edge, I think where she kind of hit her limit was there were meant to be live rats under this bit, and the mother had just seen that she was developing a bit of a nervous twitch, starting to kind of act up a bit, and it's I think we need to keep an eye on her, and it's like, no, she's not going under there. But she'd been looking at the makeup lady or something, and they had another costume or something that she was able to fit into, apparently. So yeah, it's like a makeup girl. I guess been very short, some with a wig under there, apparently.
Holy shit, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
The finale of the film is when our pal Libby, whose name I finally remembered after an hour of talking about it, Libby shows up just in time and hears while Judd's under the house, she hears Faye struggling. And after her totally gratuitous nude scene, she gets back in her dress and then she manages to rescue Faye from the bed. And then Judd springs upon them, and there's a bunch of chasing and screaming, and he nearly kills Faye by slashing her leg. And then the little girl, our pal, is trying to climb on the fence, and she's hanging upside down, dangling over the gator, and Libby shows up trying to take her down from this precarious position. Sheriff shows up, everyone's screaming, and then, of course, Judd ends up eaten by his own gator, as we knew would happen at the beginning of this frickin' movie. And then all is well. Everyone's happy. Faye is released from her psychotic marriage.
And absolutely nobody's traumatized.
Nah, dude, especially not the actors. Especially not the young child actor who was remembering Michael Myers fondly. Oh wait, this is before Michael Myers.
Yeah, no, she does. Oh my God, she does say that it's like the vibe was different with this. Halloween. It's like she didn't even realize it was a scary movie until she saw it, and she's hanging out drinking Coca-Cola with fucking Michael Myers and playing games with him. And so Jamie Lee Curtis is lovely, and this is I'm having to be chased around by a possibly really psychotic World War II veteran.
Oh my God, we didn't even go into his whole wooden leg thing.
Oh yeah.
He has a wooden leg. Roy shoots him in the leg and he screams and acts like he's in pain, except he wasn't, because it was phantom pain. That leg was lost in the war. And then he does the powders, those headache powders that they are a drug, but they're not something that I would say, because my friend takes them. Yeah. He says they're the fastest working way to cure a headache is to take these powders. But according to the trivia, the oldest man in Texas, this real person, one of his claims to fame of why he had lived so long was snorting those powders.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, why would you snort? I guess cocaine, you don't eat cocaine, but you could.
Yeah,
I don't know, dude.
It really threw me this. I mean, I think the main thing that does that made me think it would be speed or something. And before I was looking into all this, when he says BC headache powder or something, is the Bud? I'm sure that's what he brings him when he he's trying to sort of. I'm sure he gives him a packet of it or something when he.
Yes.
He's trying to sort of bribe him to, to get a room later.
Oh my God, it's so good! It's so good. And then his leg, his wooden leg, is what floats up to the surface.
Oh, yeah, the very final shot. I love that. And now you've kind of got the moonlight or whatever, sort of twinkling on the water with the music.
You know what? You know what would have been better?
Mm-hmm.
A little title card that said 2 weeks later, and it's just the alligator crapping out that leg undigested.
Ooh,
I can't move that leg.
Yeah, that would have been the perfect. You don't get them in every movie, but you know where you get like a little 5 second post credit like coda or something.
Yeah, that's an alligator's butthole.
Yeah.
In fact, Hollywood insiders, they call that the alligator's butthole. But I'm really great. I'm on a tangent here. But yeah, so that's the movie. Let's talk trivia before we get to how much we obviously hate this movie. I love how this has fallen into the public domain.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. This is on 50 Horror Classics. But when they ripped the movie, they screwed it up.
Mm.
And at near the end of the movie, it switches to the menu. So on 50 Horror Classics, this is actually a trivia someone contributed. It supposedly goes back to the menu and you can't watch the end of the movie, which I love.
What?
Yep. Some of the film was to be shot in Amarillo, Texas. But like the other shooting at that nature preserve, it was just too expensive. So they didn't do it, which is fine.
Yeah, I think the only stuff outside the soundstage that they did was apparently the bar scene. I think was a real nightclub.
Wow. Okay. It looked real.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything in this, it's like the production design is really nicely detailed. Everything feels very kind of lived in, which does ground and give a nice kind of contrast to just how surreal everything is, and maybe heightens that. I don't know.
Yeah, and it does feel stagey. There's parts of the house that just feel very unreal, and that's hey, if that bothers you, whatever. But if you're like me and Simon here, it's just one of those things. Like that extra layer of weirdness just makes a film even more endearing. I just love that stuff.
It makes me think a bit of. I don't know, Brad, God bless him, when he did a shout out to him and to Scott, actually, for Brad's review, he did, I think, of the Arrow Blu-ray for Eurocult AV, where I'd said to him that it reminded me a bit of Inferno, and you know how that has a very unreal kind of, sort of studio shot, and obviously shot in Italy, version of New York, which is kind of also, you get the same thing, maybe even more so, I don't know, in Eyes Wide Shut, because that was all filmed on studios in England.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It made like the whole of the fucking East Village inside a soundstage.
So insane.
Yeah.
So, hey, that's Kubrick, man.
Mm.
Love it. So, according to the makeup artist, cinematographer Robert Caramico had to direct several scenes because Tuber was arguing with producers would just walk off set a lot.
Yeah.
So in order to get the movie finished, they had to do a little creative directing there, some outside of the box thinking.
Well, speaking of Robert Caramico, he to me is kind of one of the MVPs of this movie. It reminds me again the vibe very much of there's a few this film, and there's for a few reasons, like Mel Ferrer being in it, and some of the I've made the Inferno comparison, is one of those like American films, I think really all of the 70s, that give me kind of the Euro horror vibe. I'm thinking
I know what you're gonna say,
like Messiah of Evil, and I think he'd shot 3 years before this Lemora, A Child's Tale of the Supernatural, which has a very similar surreal vibe to it.
Absolutely. That would make a great double feature with this. Very strange. Let's see. What else did this guy do? He shot...
Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
Yes. He was unfortunately part of that, which is... If you haven't seen that, don't. It's crazy. He directed... He shot Blackenstein.
Oh, right.
Which is a lot of fun.
I think maybe one... You know, he's 2 directing credits. Oh, right. 3 episodes of The New Lassie between 1989 and 1992. And something I did look up, which sounds very, sounds quite something, Sex Ritual of the Occult.
Oh, man.
From 1970.
Wow, he was the director and the cinematographer on Sex Rituals of the Occult.
Yeah.
A drama, a fakeumentary adult movie. I would watch that. He directed Slithus. Wow, he also did Slithus with, I think Glenn asked us to cover Slithus as well.
Slithus.
Let me confirm this. somebody in our listener requests said,
Spawn of the Slithis, is that it?
Yep. Yeah, Glenn wanted us to do Slithis, so maybe we need to come back and do that sometime.
Yeah, no, I'll make a note of that. I've never even heard of that. It sounds very intriguing.
The monster looks hilarious.
I don't even know what it's doing on the cover. Oh, my God.
I love that I brought up the trivia about the DVD failing. I think that's like trivia I am like personally really into. Like, folks at home, you want to know how boring I am. There you go. What else you got as far as wonderful tidbits?
Oh, there was one thing I was going to say. We got a lot of lovely sex fog in this, sort of getting to the atmosphere. And I was asking myself, it's like, what exactly is in the swamp? Is it bong water?
There's a moment where I think somebody's cigar smoke is hanging in the air, and I'm like, oh my God, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I think
so,
that's
gorgeous,
making Malfoy kind of cough a bit as well, bless him.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, they're disgusting. Oh yes, of course. This was a video nasty.
Yes.
It passed the theatrical release in 1978. But when then Vipco put it out in 82 under its Death Trap title, it became a video nasty to be prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act.
Yeah, that was on the Section 2 list, which I think it was a Section 2 list, which means it was not actually prosecuted, but it was still one of the notorious ones. And I found it funny when I was looking for that clip to send you that the film that appears before that, so obviously it's all alphabetical, is Dead and Buried. Robert Englund, which again is another film, but that's a bit later, that slightly gives me the Euro horror vibe.
You know, that's a classic episode. Brad and I did Dead and Buried a while ago. Check that out. Love that movie. And that's one of those things that Dead and Buried, it does have its excesses.
Yeah.
Because the studio demanded more gore be put in. And the gore scenes are, of course, ridiculous. And the director hates them, which is also ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
The movie is so wonderful, but it feels like a prestigious, wonderful film that affected me emotionally as a kid. Like, I didn't remember the gore.
Yeah.
I remember the movie being very, like, painful.
Yeah.
Like, emotionally. And so that's, I think, Mary Whitehouse, one of the greatest, smartest people of the 80s. What a wonderful woman. This film was cut by 25 seconds when it finally was released in 1992. And then it wasn't until 2000, frickin' 24 years after it had come out, it was released uncut on DVD.
Holy shit.
Ridiculous.
It's okay. Oh, God, we're coming full circle. I was looking at some trivia page. And two things at the bottom here. It was like, what the fuck? Said it frequently rained in Sri Lanka during the shooting of this film. And below that, product placement of J&B Scotch whiskey never lasts. And I was like, what? And then it's like, I realized I was looking at the 1980 Eaten Alive exclamation mark trivia page.
We were watching Rest in Pieces last night, and they had a very prominently featured bottle of J&B. I'm like, oh, this is a Giallo.
Oh, yeah. You know it.
Well, let me also, one more thing. Mm-hmm. The most disturbing part of Eaten Alive is Robert Englund trying to force himself on Clara at the beginning. That is the most disturbing part of this movie. Like, that is like a deal breaker for some people. I can imagine some people turning this movie off before that scene's even gone through.
Yeah, it's weird because
I know, completion, man.
I know you're kind of similar to me in that respect. That those sort of scenes in movies often can potentially. But it's weird because the film starts with that, but still, I don't know, for whatever reason, it's not something that stopped me from like rewatching it over and over and over.
Oh no, it's the thing is with rape scenes, and I'm sure I've talked about this forever.
Yeah,
is that. It's like if it's done in a way that makes your skin crawl and it's not trying to be sexy and it's part of the story and it's to explain a character. Yeah. And honestly, if a rape scene in a movie doesn't make you feel like shit, like I'm not saying something's wrong with you, but it's not good. But and that one is just like, it's harrowing. You realize how much you care about the character that is going to be a victim.
Yeah.
And I think that's effective. That kind of stuff does wear me down. And of course, the worst thing that can happen in a movie with a rape scene, the victim decides they wanted it.
Oh, no.
Victim gets into it. And I'm like, that is a cinematic crime.
Yeah.
That is, or worse, the rape happens and it's like nothing happened. The character doesn't change, which is why I never watched the European cut of Tombs of the Blind Dead.
I love
Tombs of the Blind Dead. Saw it when Elvira showed it back in the 80s. Have loved it ever since. Got that freaking DVD. I was like, oh, a European cut? Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. I just remembered.
Character, I believe, not only does she resist at first and then gives in and lets it happen, if you take it out of the movie, it doesn't affect her character or her relationship with the guy who raped her in any way.
Yeah, it's just completely. Yeah, I mean, yeah, gratuitous is no other word.
Hate that shit.
You know? Yeah,
there's a couple giallo movies too where that happens, where the victim gets into it because they were just dressing sexy to they deserved it kind of bullshit, and I'm like, I am the scream painting.
Yeah,
but I'm shoving both my hands up my ass and ripping my freaking heart out so I'll die faster. Probably could have gone through a different orifice, but anyway. No, I yes, thank you for letting me ramble.
No, not at all. Maybe last bits of trivia. One thing, the croc alligator, I think. Yeah, same as a croc. whatever. was provided apparently because part of the genesis for this was they'd watched Jaws and thought, you know, we want to do something like that, but with, you know, with crocodiles. They'd got it apparently off a guy called Robert A. Mattei, who did the special effects on Jaws. And yeah, like the shark in Jaws, apparently this fucking thing never worked. And I've already told the story about it being, you know, it's gaining some weight and all of that. It's but yeah, it was on, how was Toby Hooper describing it? He said it was like a little child's duck toy or something, you know, like on wheels. And I've seen some the scenes, things where it's all like on tracks and stuff, basically, a little train tracks carting it around.
So
it
cute. Looks,
it does, yeah.
That's how I move around my house. I'm only on tracks.
Oh, God, I need some at this point, I think. Jeez. was there anything else? And that's, as always, what I'd say with these things. It's like, if you love this film, then, yeah, again, Arrow Video. You know, they got, if you don't have it already, they have your back for, just stacked extras and absolutely. I feel really quite blessed that first time I actually ever saw this film was I just bought it on a blind buy on the Blu-ray. I'd never seen it, apart from the, I think my introduction to it probably was that Video Nasty set where they're talking about it and the trailer's on there, but that was like years before it ever came to HD.
I remember renting the tape when I was a kid, and then being just, what did I just watch? What? And then not seeing it again until the DVD era. And then just randomly upgraded to I bought the Dark Sky Films DVD.
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, I just never watched it. I had it and I never watched it. And then for some reason, as soon as Arrow put out the freaking Blu-ray, just upgraded and I still didn't watch it for years. Like this episode, my first viewing in, God bless America, at least 15 years.
Oh, wow.
It's been a long time. It's one of those movies I love, but I don't break out very often. It's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You've got to be in a certain frame of mind to be ready for it.
Got you.
Before we talk about how we feel about it, though, I do have a joke from my dad.
Okay.
So my dad told a joke. I'm going to change the characters to protect, bless my father's heart for telling me the more colorful version of this joke. So let's say, for purposes of this episode and for the future of my great country of America, two rednecks are sitting on a dock in Florida and they are listening to the mating calls of alligators because, of course, it's summertime and they're drinking. And one says to the other, "Hey, man, what's meaner, crocodile or an alligator?" And his friend thinks about it for a minute. He's like, "Well, I gotta say, I believe it's meaner than both of those is the crocogator." He's like, "Man, what is a crocogator?" He's like, "Well, crocogator is an alligator on one end, and a crocodile on the other." The other friend goes, "That's crazy. How does he shit?" And he says, why do you think he's so mean? Get it? Because he can't poop. Yeah, my dad told me that joke.
Nice.
Oh, man. Well, it really sucks the air out of the room. No, it's okay. But I told it. So, Simon, can you recover and tell me, how do you feel? How does this movie make your crocagator tingle?
On a scale of... on a scale? Yeah, no, we'll call this like a 10 or 11. I mean, this movie to me is quite possibly tied with The Funhouse as my favorite Toby Hooper film. Although, it's hard to say, it's like the more I rewatch all of them. I mean, again, you know, Texas Chainsaw is like Natch. You know, it's like that. But that's more like, no, that would be like a kind of best versus favorite thing, wouldn't it? And I love that film, don't get me wrong, but I'm more inclined to rewatch The Funhouse or this, or Texas Chainsaw 2, you know, which rewatching that last night, they're just all just so wonderful, really. But there's just something so special about this film and how it just feels, say, so authentically just unhinged and hysterical and just fevered and just weird, you know, throughout. They really kind of captured, you know, some kind of magic with this. And just like the cast as well, it's like kind of amazing, really, when you add up everybody who's in this and the other things they were in. Slam dunk, totally.
Oh, for me, I got to say, I love this as well. Mm. As I was saying, I don't reach for it very often. But I think this is probably, through circumstances and the way it turned out in the cast, this is probably one of the weirdest films of the 1970s.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, it's really, really, really weird in all respects. Mm. This is a chaotic spectacle.
Yeah.
The soundstagey shit. Is wild. The performances especially and the music combined with those performances make this feel like the entire set is just soaked in kerosene and it's about to go up at any second. Like, it just feels like this ramshackle insanity and it did fall apart. Mm-hmm. Like, when the director storms off the set and somebody behind the camera goes, keep filming. Like, that means it has broken. This is like a total freak fest. Like, I am surprised, like shocked that this didn't go more funhousey and have like a weird, like a little person character show up or a former circus clown who happens to live in the bathroom.
It would have been perfect.
We didn't even talk about the monkey. Oh my God. Like,
yeah.
Speaking of like, did they or didn't they kill an animal? Like, Judd has this monkey, and the monkey, they obviously drugged this monkey because it acts like it is wasted.
It seems that way, but I was kind of confused with this. So, and again, I want to say it was on the first Toby Hooper interview where, again, he's not exactly 100% coherent. Again, you know, I'm not judging. Where he says something about, like, this monkey just, like, knew its time was up or something. It's almost like he was implying that it, like, gave up the ghost, you know, in the film.
It is sad. It is weird. It's very affecting. It adds another layer. If that monkey just croaked, hey, that doesn't make me happy.
No.
But they didn't do it. It doesn't seem as though they did anything egregious.
No.
You know, it's like those freaking cats in... Umberto Lenzi, speaking of animal murderers, Umberto Lenzi doing drugging those cats.
Oh, yeah.
Seven bloodstained orchids. Yeah. And you're like, please, God, let them have survived their big scene. Oh, man, that's awful.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite giallo.
I hear that. No, I know what you mean every time I see that scene like you. And I'm sure you even more being a cat owner, you're like, just Lenzi, just why? But
dude,
it's funny.
My cat knows we're talking about that scene. She just attacked my chair while we were sitting here.
Like, perfect.
Represent my people, motherfucker.
Oh, no, the cats of Ulthar are coming back, are they?
Yep. Yeah, she flew in on a cloud and freaking ate an entire regiment of alien soldiers that were trying to kill me. That's right. I've read Dream Quest of the Unknown Kadath. Thank you.
I've started like an audiobook of that a few times, but I've just I will get to it eventually. But
was it read by freaking Werner Herzog?
Sadly, not. That would be perfect.
Can you imagine H.P. Lovecraft read by Werner Herzog? I can't even do a Herzog impression, but that would be good.
Oh, indeed. A couple of your comments, sir, they just reminded me of like one quote, I think, from the second Toby Hooper interview where he summed it up as a carnival of insanity. I just thought that just, yeah, that hits the nail right on the head, doesn't it?
See, I love him because he's like, you could tell he wasn't happy with how things turned out, but he's willing to look back on it and hype it. I love that. Yeah, it's so
totally,
good.
Totally.
I think you mean Toberly.
Yeah, perfect.
It's a crocagator. How does it poop? Hey. Well, Glenn Del Rossi, our friend of the show, thank you so much for picking this movie for us to talk about because it's wonderful. We'll figure out the Slithus situation. As instead of the spawning of the Slither, this should have been called the Slithus situation. And Simon, thank you for freaking hanging out, dude.
Oh no, always a pleasure, man. And sorry, that's one last thing I was going to say. So we a little peek behind the curtain. We kind of deferred recording this because I know you weren't so well a few weeks back. And I was thinking, could you imagine if you'd watched this movie back then and you're kind of like fevered state?
Ooh, yeah, that second dose of that Pfizer, man, it gave me all the thrills of a flu, but without it going into my sinuses. So I was just super disoriented and teeth chattering, fever and chills. Okay. Yeah, I should have been like insisted that we recorded, not the following morning when we were going to, but that night when I was like freaking out. That would have been great.
Oh man,
we'll do an audio commentary while I'm under the. under the influence of Pfizer. Folks, please take care of your monkeys and your dogs and your cats and your gators.
Your crocodiles.
Don't let your gators grow up to be crocodiles or whatever.
Especially not crocodiles either, because they need to be able to
poop. God, no, they can't shit. So
constipation, that will drive you psychotic.
See, that's the problem with the human centipede. It should have just been two people connected at the butthole. We gotta go. Folks, bye.
Bye.
Hello, This Is the Doom Show is a proud member of the Legion Podcast Network. Please check out the other podcasts on legionpodcasts.com. If you'd like more Hello, This Is the Doom Show, go to hellodoomshow.podomatic.com or go to doomedmoviethon.com for the archives. If that's still not enough, go to @doomedmoviethon on Twitter. You can write in to Hello, This Is the Doom Show. Use the email doomedmoviethon@gmail.com. Doom Show episodes are available on record and 8-track cassette.